Yes, well, so, how did you get into educational history?
Well, it was part, really, of my training in the history of American civilization, which is what I did as a graduate student. And I picked the history of education as part of that, because in Germany I had done work in education, so I thought I'd continue that.
Now, excuse me, I think it would be a good idea if you would come close enough, and if you could actually hold on to this and speak into it, because we'll get serious. And when I ask a question, this won't.
Just why don't you pull that chair a little closer than this? This is pretty tight. Yeah, this is a lot better. Sure. Mm-hmm. That should do.
And when I want to ask a question, you can pass it to me.
Turn it.
Start again.
I got into the history of American education because it was a minor field that I had in my PhD training in the history of American civilization. And that, again, I picked because before I came to Harvard, I had been working in Germany with American officials on German education. So that was an interest I had, and I continued that.
And you were from Germany?
Originally, yes. Yes, I came from Germany.
Mm-hmm. You came here. When did you come here?
First as a student in 1948, and then again to stay here in 1954.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'd be interested in today is to have you describe a project. You're going to talk about the one you're working on now.
Yes, surely. Yeah, that is the legal history of American colleges and universities to the time of the Dartmouth College case in 1819, which is the first time that a college or university issue came up to the United States Supreme Court. And in fact, legally confirmed and set up our two-pronged educational system of both public and private institution, which makes us quite different from, for example, Europe, where about 99% of all college-type and institutions and universities are public. And so the Dartmouth College case is a key document in that whole history. And I was very interested and intrigued how it had come about that this developed. That in a general sense, and then quite specifically in 1967, 1968, at the time of the unrest in the universities, there were a number of court cases here in the Federal Court of the Western District of Wisconsin, Judge Doyle's court, at which time Judge Doyle asked me to write him a paper on the relationship between civil and university jurisdiction. And that was, you know, with court deadlines, all that, and I did it. But I also knew at the time that I was talking about something I really knew very little about. And so essentially I said to myself, I've got to do this right. And so I've been doing that ever since.
And this fitted in because you weren't at the time working on another topic?
I was at the time working on another subject with a far more general history of education. In fact, with the phenomenology of education, what does education mean? But I gave that up when these much more pressing issues came about and decided to do that first. The phenomenology will come later when I'm through with this.
So how did you go about doing it?
Well, basically, I had to familiarize myself first with a certain amount of legal matters of which I knew nothing. So I did a great deal of reading in histories of law, and English, particularly English court reports, since the origins of our system obviously go back to Europe. And I had to look into that first. So that was, in a sense, the first stage. The second, then, was a great deal of time spent in university archives, mainly on the East Coast, since that's where our early colleges and universities were, to dig into their archives, into their papers, to see what I could find out. And essentially what I looked for were always matters of conflict. Conflict between the faculty and their head, their president, the teachers and the president of the college, the students and the faculty, the colonial government and the university. And when it happened, court cases that had come up having something to do with students or with faculty or with administration. So essentially, that whole problem of public controversy is what interested me, and I rather systematically went through that and went through the various archives to see what I could learn. And that's the hard core of the material that will be in the book. A story and an interpretation, of course, of these conflicts, what they really had to say about what kind of institution was an American college before 1819.
When did you get time to go to these Eastern archives?
I did some of that in the summer, and then I was fortunate enough to receive some grants, the National Institute of Education, the National Endowment for the Humanities. The university gave me a couple of grants, one semester each. And so whenever I could, I did it. I couldn't. There are about up to 50-some colleges founded before 1819. I obviously did not get to all 57 or whatever they were of them. In fact, that wasn't even necessary. But I did go to probably about 15. It's a rough guess. I'd have to sit down and count them again to see.
You, did you have any difficulties getting into archives or finding material?
No, in fact, I was always amazed how helpful and willing archivists were, and I became rather fond of them. And I had some marvelous experiences with them. I do remember the visits to what is now Washington and Lee University in Virginia. When I first came there, yes, they thought they had some archives, but throughout their history, which began in the late 18th century, their bursar was by definition the secretary of their trustees. And so he had the papers. So I was sent to the administration building, which was a brand new building, glass, concrete, and all that. And I got in there, and there were whirring computers and steel files, and, you know, that's like a business office. And the bursar just looked as though he perfectly were fitted into this new, brand new, modern construction. And so when I said I was interested in papers from the 18th century, he looked at me kind of queerly and said, "Well, there's a little storeroom here. Let me take you there. We'll see what we find." And indeed, there was a little storeroom. It was sort of an enlarged janitor's closet. And a totally different atmosphere prevailed there. First of all, the dust was inch thick. There was no gleam, no steel, no whirring computers, but very old-fashioned furniture. So obviously, all kind of junk had been piled in there, and loads of boxes. And indeed, we began to look into them, and sure enough, there were the old minutes, and there were all kinds of papers from the 18th and 19th century. And he sort of brought a dust cloth along and wiped off a piece of a part of a table and said, "Go sit down and make yourself at home," which I proceeded to do. And I stayed there for about 2 or 3 days and found a great deal of stuff, very fascinating, and was very happy. And then I went home. And about a year and a half later, I received a letter from the librarian of Washington and Lee University, telling me with great joy that the library had just acquired all the papers that had been in the bursar's possession, and they were now opening up the archives of Washington and Lee University. And they thanked me profoundly because I had sort of given the impetus for them to start a university archives. Well, you know, that kind of thing makes you feel rather good, and I thought that was very, very nice. Now, and most places that I did go did have archives set up by themselves, but all of them, you know, without exception, were exceedingly interested in what I was doing and gave me all the help I could possibly ask for. So I have, and then they themselves got interested and began looking for things, you know, to help out. So I have nothing but exceedingly pleasurable memories of all these research trips.
Could you give me an example of a case of conflict that you found that would be of interest?
Yes, in the early days, one of the disputes that came up at a number of institutions was between the colonial government, or after the revolution, the state legislature, and the university. That the university, out of their tradition of English law, always claimed to be a corporation under a charter which was could not be touched by governmental interference. And to the contrary, the government is usually claiming that they had a responsibility and could either alter the charters or just interfere in the college's affairs. And that is one of the constant themes. In fact, it is the main theme in the Dartmouth case itself, but it has a long history preceding the case itself of similar events before. Though that struggle is really one of the main theme. Another one are disgruntled students who try to sue the university. And the first time that happened, I forgot the year now, I have to look it up again, was early at Harvard College. And there the interesting thing was that the student tried to bring the university into court, into county court in Charlestown, near Boston. And the university's main concern then was that it was a provincial institution, that is to say, it was an institution of the province, what now is the state of Massachusetts and then the colony of Massachusetts Bay, and that as a provincial institution, it could not be brought into a county court. That, in fact, the only court it would acknowledge was the court which had founded Harvard College itself, namely the general court, in today's language, would have been the state legislature, the assembly, of the colony of Massachusetts. So they fought very vigorously against being hauled into county court and prevailed, of course, in those days. But that's the type of...
The
issue was that the particular student had made... I forgot, as a matter of fact, by now, it's years back that I had worked on that, and I have to come back to it now. The student had, in one form or another, insulted the government of the college by having made some disparaging remarks publicly. And therefore, the college refused to give him his master's degree. That's what it was. And so the student demanded that he had to get his master's degree and he couldn't be withheld on these grounds. And then that matter went into court.
Times have certainly changed, haven't
they? Oh, yes.
Insulting remarks.
But what interests me about it is, in the context of current discussions in the 1960s, we all then seemed to think that it was unheard of that a student would drag a college into court, and that riots and such things, you know, I remember back in the 50s, we used to say, well, we read in the newspapers, Egyptian students were rioting, Persian students were rioting. Such things never happened in America, certainly not in America of the 50s. So when the 60s burst upon us, we all thought this was all brand novel. Well, the point is, it's novel at all. We've had riots, we had court cases way throughout our history, but somehow by the 50s we seem to have forgotten it all. It seems as though a brand new affair had come upon us. That's one thing that I found out, that there was ample precedent for these matters. And there are other, to me, very fascinating themes that, again, really tie up with our thinking of the 50s and 60s. I remember that one of the first sentiments among the faculty at the time always was that a state legislature had absolutely no right in any way to interfere into affairs of a university, that faculty members stood on grounds of academic freedom and legislators stay out. And the argument that one heard at first had something to do with the corporation of professors that made up a university, which is a medieval idea, and which is historically correct. That's the way universities had originally been founded by scholars coming together, banding themselves together, forming a corporation, and governing themselves. Well, there's a lot of time intervened between the medieval period, and for my purposes and for the whole history of American college, the far more important part is that played by the Reformation. Which is this being registered now? Is that needle? What the Reformation did, in short, was to bring state, church, and religion together. For example, if the King of Saxony was a Protestant, then because he was a Protestant, his subjects had to be Protestants, and the Protestant church was the established or state church. And the same thing happened in Bavaria, only there it was a Catholic church. And the point is, in America, we started out that way too, to some extent. Virginia was, by definition, Anglican as a British colony. But Massachusetts was settled by Puritans who became Congregationalists, and so that was the established church. Well, that didn't work in Pennsylvania, for example. Well, you had Quakers and Lutherans and Schwenkfelders and Pietists and, you know, a great diversity of groups. And because of that, the notion of an established church with an established college became more and more difficult. And in fact, it was in New Jersey where you, for the first time, had a second college founded. It was then called Queens, and it's now today known as Rutgers. That was the second college after the established College of New Jersey, which today is known as Princeton. Now, Princeton was the provincial established college. Rutgers, or Queens, was this new type of thing that was specifically founded for Dutch Reform people who no longer wanted to have their children to send back to the Netherlands, but wanted to give them a college education in the colony. And it's out of such beginnings that you get non-established colleges, which in fact later then became what we know as the private colleges. And there the two-pronged system really began. And it was again the Dartmouth College case that in 1819 put, if you will, the legal seal of approval on this development, which made us really quite different from Europe. And the reason, of course, is that of pluralism. You know, that they ask the why question, and when you ask the why question on this subject, then you really start talking about American history quite in general. This doesn't just explain the colleges. This is one of the key facts of what America is all about, that we are such a heterogeneous nation, for which there really, I should say, very few precedents. Switzerland, of course, comes to mind, but by and large, for which there really had not been many precedents in the old world. And here, then, where the college history comes together with the broad American themes.
Have you finished your research on this?
Oh, about 7/8 of it. I'm now writing on what I hope will be the last chapter, namely the Dartmouth College case in itself. And then what's left is to take all the chapters or independent essays that I've written so far and put them together as one book, which means a bit of revamping, shortening, and putting together, and developing one main theme throughout it.
When do you do this? I know you have this office here in the History Building, and you work here in the morning. And
yes, my best time for this type of work is in the mornings when I'm freshest. So now, of course, I'm on leave, and I can do it all day. But during when I'm not on leave and when I've worked on this, I've always tried to do this in the morning and to be with my students, do my teaching and whatever administrative duties there are in the afternoon. And in the evenings, I prepare the next day's classes. That's been the pattern.
And do you work weekends, too?
Oh, yes, sure. You know, the marvelous part of a professor's life is that he can say, she can say, too, that my work is my hobby or my hobby is my work. So I don't really distinguish, you know, 40 hours of work and then something else. It's all part of the same.
What is your wife feel about? How is she affected by this?
Well, I don't think it's very easy on spouses in that type of situation when your husband or your wife is engaged in something like this. It obviously does not give me to her as much as she might like to. And that's a problem, yes.
That you never can, you can't go out and close the office door.
Well, one doesn't. Once you are working on something like this where you're searching for explanations, where something's in your mind where you know you have, let's say, 7/8 of a story, but a part is missing, that doesn't let you go. You worry about it. And in fact, sometimes the answers don't always come out of further documents, because in so many cases there simply aren't any more documents. There are no more facts to be found. But it is your own working mind that has to supply the connections. And that comes at the most unexpected hours. And then when you get it, you sometimes rush for a piece of paper to jot it down before you forget it again. So, you know, it works in you all the time.
What happens to your teaching? How is your teaching affected by it?
Well, in much the same way. In fact, I can't conceive of my teaching without this type of work. If it weren't for this kind of research, if it weren't for this being involved in an ongoing process of exploration and further thoughts and discoveries, I would think my teaching would be rather dull. Of course, it may be dull anyway, but I hope not. And
I
if it isn't,
you're a very good teacher.
Well, if it isn't, it comes through this. The way I notice it myself, and of course you realize it's my students who should be saying that and noticing it, but to the extent that I notice it, it's the fact that I not very often teach the same course twice. I don't mean that I don't teach the history of American education in various semesters, but what I do within the course changes. And it comes from new insights that one gains. And the thing is, when you gain an insight, let's say, out of a particular event or a happening, let's say in 1812, you begin to realize that it doesn't just apply to 1812, but if the true insight of how things work, you begin to apply it to the rest of your history wherever it is possible to apply it, and you try it out and to look for new revelations in that way. So your teaching is, in effect, permeated with that.
So research doesn't interfere with teaching?
Oh, I would never say it interferes. No, it helps. It flows into it. Teaching really isn't possible. Good teaching, I mean, with the teacher being inspired. And the question is, where does the inspiration come from? And I'll just be careful and speak for myself, and I say it does come from research. It does come from the kind of questions that come from your contemplating new facts, new data that you hadn't known before, and you ask yourself over and over again, what does it all mean? And that, I think, is the key question. And to keep that question fresh and to have it recurring without, you know, becoming just simple repetition, you need new materials, materials you hadn't seen before, events you hadn't heard of before, that set up new questions in your mind, which then eventually always come round to it all. When you have it all done, just as I told you now, I'm 7/8 done, and I look at all the little points I've already accumulated, and I ask myself, what's the big picture? What does it really, in one big thing, all add up to? And wrestling with that, to come to final interpretations of what your history, what your data mean, that is, you know, what's always on your mind. And because it's always on your mind, it naturally gets into your teaching. And without that, I think your teaching, or one's teaching, would be rather lifeless. It would very often simply be repetition, you know, the same facts. You could always say what happened in 1812, but that's not really the point. You want to find out, well, whatever happened, what that means, and what it might mean. And that changes, too, with the world that you live in yourself. You know, new questions come from your own life, from your own times, and that's why history is always, and always has to be, rewritten.